All right, let's recover from that error and start over again. So I have to disclose that the first eight authors have actually spent most of the last 10 years of their life building this system. My involvement has been very limited to the last 2 years, and so I'm going to use two pronouns very, very carefully. When I use the word we, as in we built this system, I mean the first eight authors on the paper. Okay? And when I use the word I, as in I have no idea, that means I, Galen Hunt, have no idea, but the other eight authors probably actually have a very good response. Okay? All right. I also need to make a couple of other revelations, let's call them, more disclosures. Software has bugs. Even shipping software has bugs. Even Microsoft shipping software has bugs. I know, pick yourselves up off the floor. Okay, oh, and by the way, so does your hardware, and we're gonna come back to that point toward the end of the talk. Okay, so I wanna put a couple of definitions for you so we're really clear about what we're talking about. A bug is a flaw in program logic. So for example, my little program here that sets my var to 5 didn't realize that my var is actually a macro that randomly generates an address. Okay, that's a bug. And yes, bugs like that do actually appear in code. And an error is a failed execution that was caused by the bug. So a given error, if I run a program 5,000 times that has this bug, it may generate 5,000 errors. Okay? So one bug may cause many, many errors. And we'll get to some very large numbers very quickly. So the challenge is Microsoft ships software to approximately 1 billion users. And well, when something goes wrong, when somebody hits one of our bugs, how do we find out when things actually do go wrong? Well, we want to fix all the bugs, regardless of their source, whether it's the application or the operating system, whether it's in software or hardware or caused by malware. We also want to prioritize the bugs that affect the most users. So if many, many users are hitting a bug, that's the one that we care about fixing first. And we also want to generalize the solution so that it can be used by any programmer, inside or outside of Microsoft. Now, what kind of bugs do we want to fix? Well, all of them, okay? We want to fix crashes, kernel crashes, in other words, blue screens of death. We want to fix application crashes, installation failures, even invariant violations within programs, okay? Anything that's a bad event, we'd like to put an end to it. So the system we build is called Windows Error Reporting. And I suspect most of you have actually seen it in operation. Okay? You've probably seen one of these two dialogues. What I'm going to tell you about today is what's behind the dialogues and what happens after you click, yes, send error report. Okay? We're by the numbers. Let's introduce it a different way. The system has collected billions of error reports, application, operating systems, and hardware error-related error reports. We have 1 billion installed clients. The system, back-end service is provisioned to handle over 100 million error reports today. It's over-provisioned specifically so that we can tolerate global correlated events like worms. The system has collected error reports from over 17 million programs. Basically, if your program has ever run on Windows, the odds are we've got an error report for you. It's been used by over 700 companies outside of Microsoft. The system is about 60, the back-end system is about 60 servers, and it scales so well that we actually only have 2 servers record every error that occurs on every Windows machine everywhere in the world, okay? And it's been in use for 10 years. And lastly, the number one, how many programmers does it require to get access to Word data? Just one. Literally anybody in this audience can get access to Word data for your program, okay? So I've given you a brief introduction. Now I'm going to talk about how we actually go about processing billions of error reports and making sense of them. Then I'm going to give you talk about some of the experiences over the last 10 years, finding and correcting bugs in software, hardware, and in malware, and then I'll stop talking. So let's put Word in context. Let's talk about debugging in the very small. So all of you in this room, I suspect, have all written a program, and you've given it to a user, and the user hit a bug and reported that bug to you, okay? And you, say, reproduce the error, or maybe you attached your debugger up to the user's program to figure out what was going on. You gave them a fix, and life was wonderful, okay? Well, now imagine your problem's a little bit harder. Imagine that you've shipped your program to, say, a few hundred million users, And one of them hits a bug, what happens? Well, and particularly what happened before we had were, and what I suspect happens in most organizations these days, is that the user calls technical report, some support technician tries to diagnose the error, and then in our case, the support technicians would meet with the programmers approximately once a year and say, here are the top 10 errors that we see users hitting. And by the way, they thought like one of the top errors was that users were editing binaries. They thought that was the number three most likely error, okay? Don't ask me where they got that one from. Well, okay, so the problem with this is the human bottleneck, okay? So first of all, you can't hire enough technicians to answer the telephone, okay? The data that you get is inaccurate, both what you get from the users and what you get from the technicians. It's hard to get additional data when you need it. You have no global baseline. You have no idea actually how many people are encountering an error. And it's useless for Heisenbugs because you can't get them back on the telephone the next time the error happens because it probably happens to some completely different user. So fundamentally what we need to do is remove the humans from the loop. And that was our goal. So our goal was to build a data collection system that would allow one service to record every error, application, operating system, hardware, on every Windows system worldwide. And what we believed is that if we could measure these things, we could fix them. Okay. Now, I'm going to ground this a little bit with an example. Let's say somebody in this audience wrote a plugin for Outlook, okay, and it happened to contain this function that has the bug that if it takes two parameters, and if the first parameter happens to be odd, then it randomly generates an address and writes a word into that address, okay? And they ship this out to millions of customers. Well, what happens with were is when that program writes to an invalid address and crashes the program, we collect what we call a mini dump, okay? It consists of the stack of the thread that encountered the error and some additional, a very small amount of additional data from in that process. And then we ask the user, is it okay if we report this error to Microsoft? The user says yes. We send the mini dump up to the servers at Microsoft. And then on the servers, there's a program we call Bang Analyze that takes every single one of those mini dumps and runs through it. And what it attempts to do is determine what is the root cause. And then it classifies errors into what we call buckets. A bucket is a collection of error reports that are likely to have originated from the same bug. Okay? And it keeps track of how many hits there were on each one of these buckets. Okay? And the programmers can use that to prioritize what they fix. Now, the heart of the system is this Bang Analyze tool. Bang Analyze is an extension to the debugging tools for Windows. You can actually go download it right now and run it on your own desktop, on your own private crashes if you want. It takes as input a mini dump, and an output is a bucket ID. And it runs on all of our worst servers. And then and Bang Analyze has approximately 500 heuristics. It grows at the rate of roughly one heuristic per week. And we do rerun it on old data. Okay, so to recap what I told you. Well, so the client collects a mini dump automatically without any interaction from the programmer, purely because the system program happens to be running on Windows. It sends a mini dump to the servers. Bang Analyze buckets the error with similar reports. It increments the bucket count. And then the programmers prioritize the buckets with the highest counts. Those are the ones that go fix. Now, actually, it doesn't quite work like this. Okay, because if it worked like that, it wouldn't scale. It actually works. One of the things it does is it only uploads the first few mini dumps for the first few hits on a bucket. After that, it just increments the count. Okay. In addition, quite often you need additional data beyond what's needed in a mini dump. So you need a full memory dump. You might need dumps from other processes. And programmers can request that this additional data be collected in future hits on the same error report. Okay. Now, the system scales because we actually employ a two-phase bucketing strategy. We do a first step of bucketing called labeling that happens actually on the client based on immediate data of where the failure occurred at the observation point. And so, for example, the bucket ID might come out to be outlook.exe plugin with plugin.dll version 1.0.2305 at offset 23F5 inside the program. Okay, and that's a generic mechanism that's used to create that first failure point. Then once the mini dump reaches the servers, we use Bang Analyze to rebucket as we move toward the root cause. And as we gain additional data, we keep rebucketing the error reports. And so, for example, one of the first things we'll do is we'll go look and see, do we have debugging symbols for this process? And if we do, we can figure out, well, that this symbol, this offset 23F5, actually is within the memcopy routine. Okay, so that brings us one step closer. Then we can employ some of our statistical debugging techniques. And one of those is that we know that memcopy actually doesn't have very many bugs in it, but it typically is the callers of memcopy. And so then we replace the ID and move to a new bucket ID, which is the method foo within plugin.dll running within outlook.exe. And then we have more and more heuristics that we apply. The paper has significantly more detail on the bucketing heuristics, and that's as far as I'm going to take them right now. Now, bucketing mostly works. As I said, these are heuristics. And in fact, bucketing can fail in one of two ways. The first way is that one bug, which is generating many error reports, those error reports can hit multiple buckets. Okay, so imagine that, to illustrate this example, the memcopy example I showed, you can think of two primary failure cases. One of them is that the random address that is chosen is an invalid, is unmapped memory, okay? In which case, we immediately segfault within memcopy. The other case is where it picks an address inside the data section of the program. And so it's going to randomly scribble over some piece of data within the process. And at some point in the future, the process is going to fail and may actually fail in many, many different ways. And so those other ways will result in additional buckets. And that happens approximately, we believe, as much as 40% of all error reports get bucketed in duplicate buckets. This causes extra server load. It also means that when we go to debug these duplicate buckets, that we have to hand triage them. Okay. The other way the failures can happen is when we have multiple bugs hit within one bucket. Again, hard to isolate. Now you might be sitting here saying, how can a system that gets 44% of its error reports in the wrong place possibly work? Well, the answer is scale is our friend. When you have billions of error reports, throw away a few hundred thousand here, throw away a few hundred million in there, it doesn't really matter. You've still got enough to debug. Okay? So now I want to talk about some of the experiences, some of kind of the highlights over the last 10 years of using the system. First one of the questions you might ask is, well, when I get all these error reports, what does it look like? Well, the first thing you do is you put it in the graph. And what you see is the bucket hits for a given program look like a Pareto curve, okay? In this case, this was a relatively small deployment. It was an internal deployment of Microsoft Word 2010 inside Microsoft to 9,000 users over a period of just 3 weeks. And one of the things you'll notice that's common across almost on all programs and all bug distributions is that a very small number of bugs make up the vast majority of the errors that are actually reported. Okay, in this case, just 20 buckets, presumably 20, in this case actually was fewer than 20 bugs, I think it was 17, accounted for over 50% of the error reports. Well, that's good news, okay? What that means is that programmers, if you will watch the data and go fix a small number of bugs, those ones that are most important, you will impact and improve the lives of many, many of your users, okay? We've used the system widely. One of the early success stories was when, with the very first deployment of Word, we found Heisen bugs, literally within months of the system being out. We found Heisen bugs that had existed in the Windows kernel and some of the other Windows kernel mode components that had been in there since the system started, but we'd never had enough error reports, never been able to diagnose them, and suddenly we could. Another example, we had a third-party antivirus vendor who accounted for 7.6% of all Windows crashes worldwide. Okay, this is a common story, unfortunately. And we went to them and said, hey, we have this Word data, you should fix your problems. They fixed their top 20 buckets in a period of 30 days. Within roughly about 4 months, their percentage of all kernel crashes had gone from 7.6% to a manageable 3.6, okay? Now, and the other thing is, well, you can fix your bugs too. Like I said, anyone in the world can that registers with Microsoft with a small number of clicks can get access to the bug reports for your program. And I promise you, if you've got code, they're out there. Okay. Another example, we found not just software errors, but hardware errors as well. This particular case, this was a failure in a CPU, and I won't name the vendor, because I'd get shot if I did, by my co-authors, one of them who's here to shoot me if I did. But what we did is we found a large number of error reports. When we did a statistics-based analysis of it, we realized that there was a large class of the error reports for exactly the same revision, the exact same step of a particular processor. We went to the processor vendor and we said, we're not totally sure, but we believe you have a bug. And they looked at it and literally like within a day came back and said, yes, we actually knew that bug existed. We just didn't think it'd ever get hit in real life, okay? with their help, we released a workaround into Windows, and you can see very rapidly, within 2-3 days, the number of error reports coming in for that, those systems dropped down very dramatically. Okay, now two important takeaways here. One of them is this thing that we built to detect software errors helped us find hardware errors. The second one is, you know, these guys could have known they had these bugs a long time before we went to them. They actually could have registered, they could have been downloading those error reports, and they could have found and fixed the bug before it affected as many users as it did. We actually use them as a poster child as we go out and recruit other hardware vendors. Okay. Other examples of hardware failures that we found a laptop in the system management BIOS of one particular laptop. We found a buffer overrun in Resume from Sleep. This was a really fun one because what they overwrote was the name of the vendor. Okay. It reminds me of what my junior high school teacher said, which is fools' names and fools' faces are often found in public places. Okay. Another example, we had a motherboard USB controller that only implemented 31 of 32 bits in DMA. Why do you need all those bits? Unfortunately, it was the high order bit. Okay, so it appeared on machines with more than 2 gigabytes of RAM. This one was a fun one. We rapidly figured out who the vendor was because it was on the motherboard, and with statistical analysis, we found that all these bugs were coming from the same chipsets. But we didn't know which component was failing. We passed around the dumps around a number of people at Windows, and eventually somebody said, hey, I think that looks like a USB packet. And sure enough, it was. Okay. We found other failures related to overclocking, hard disk controllers that reset at unfavorable times, substandard memory, things like that. Okay. The last example I wanted to talk about was malware. So this was the Renault malware in February 2007. This was it was actually a social engineering worm. It was a piece of email that said, hey, why don't you run me something? And people ran it. And as soon as the system was infected, it caused the explorer.exe, the Windows shell, to crash. And so the experience of this is if you had this on your system, it would come up, it would start to draw your desktop, and then immediately crash. And then it would just keep redoing that over and over again. And there wasn't anything you could do about it. Okay. Well, we immediately saw a spike. We saw these error reports coming in, millions of them in a matter of days. And we released a worm removal tool through Windows Update, okay, and the machines automatically fixed themselves. Everybody who had turned on automatic update automatically fixed itself. And the great thing here is that the machines were not up; they were useless to the users because they just kept restarting the login or the shell. But as designed, Worm was able to get the errors up to Microsoft. We were able to count it. We were able to figure out what the fix, how to remove this particular virus. It wasn't an exploit, other than a social engineering exploit, and push it down to the machines without the users, even though the machines were unusable to the users. Other examples, Blaster. When Blaster came out, it accounted, on day zero, it accounted for 50% of all the error reports that we had that day. Okay, and Kirk called the Windows guys and said, you guys have a problem. And so the other takeaway of this is the system is architected. We have not changed the architecture of the server and the distributed system in the 10 years that it's been deployed, but it's trivially tolerated these global catastrophic events. Okay. Other things that we talk about in the paper, quite a bit more detail on the bucketing, quite a bit more detail on statistics-based debugging, Also, the progressive data collection and how it works. And finally, there's a whole section on changes that we've made to the operating system over time to make it easier for us to do this post-mortem debugging with WIR. So in conclusion, Windows Error Reporting was the first post-mortem reporting system with automatic error diagnosis. It's the largest client server system in the world by installs. It's helped over 700 companies, including Microsoft, fix thousands of bugs and billions of error reports. And it's really fundamentally changed the way software development works at Microsoft. Every single Microsoft product team now has ship goals based on their top ship goal is reduce our WIR error reports by this percent. Okay, it's really changed it to a very engineering, numerically driven engineering process. Or as one of the Outlook general managers said, it forced us to stop making bleep up. Okay. And finally, you know, just to come back to it, well, WIR works because bucketing mostly works, and that's actually an area where I think there's a lot of room, even with, you know, particularly within this community and maybe the PL community, to look at ways to improve the bucketing. And we'd love to make data available to people that wanted to look at that. Thank you very much. I don't know. No, actually, I do know the answer on this. So we try not to collect. So one of the nice things is most privacy data ends up in the heap, not on the stack. Okay, and so by avoiding collecting the heap, we avoid collecting privacy data there. We also do a bunch of data scrubbing. So of things we know about. So for example, we remove your SID, we remove your username, we remove things like that in the error reports we upload. It's not in the paper, but I did an analysis in preparation for the paper where I scrubbed roughly a million error reports looking to see if they had strings that were of the right format. And I had to write this code so carefully so that even the code never saw the strings. That might be social security numbers, employee identification numbers, credit card numbers, telephone numbers. Those were the ones I looked for. In 100,000, I guess it was actually, it was 100,000 error reports, I found fewer than 10 possible matches of strings. So in theory, yes, we could be collecting error data. In practice, we don't believe we are. And we also, particularly at Microsoft, we put very strong employment conditions on how this data, even the error reports, are used. Okay? Thanks. Yeah, so I have two-part answers. So one of them is we actually have a team of people at Microsoft that scrub the data, the WIR data, fairly frequently, looking for zero-day exploits. That is their job, is to use this data and try to find zero-day exploits. Because it turns out that worms and viruses are very buggy, and they send error reports. The second thing, the second thing is there was a philosophy in building this system that when things go right, there should be no overhead at all. Okay, the overheads that users pay for running WIR are zero if they never hit an error report. And when they do hit an error report, they're very, very small. 90% of users, their error report doesn't get clouded anymore. It's just an increment of a bucket count. There's no more upload than a bucket ID. And so, we could talk about doing things on the client, but we have avoided doing that because we don't want our users to pay those overheads. Yes?
Hello, Brad Morey.
And then I'll come back over to you.
I like the work. I'm pretty reassured about the privacy concerns we were just talking about.
But?
Well, I have two comments and questions. One is, it seems like other people who might have those concerns would be a lot more assuaged if you did
Okay.
I see a dialog box that I'm sending stuff to Microsoft. I'm not inclined to do that.
Yep.
And then sort of the follow-on question to that is, are you keeping track of how many people aren't sending problem reports? So you keep track of how many times you said no before you said yes?
Big brother knows, huh? No, so the answer is we have pretty good estimates of what our opt-in rate is because we have some other systems. We have a system called SQIM where we collect what's happening on correctly running systems and for customers that have opted into that. And it's a very explicit opt-in process. And that gives us a pretty good idea of what kind of opt-in rates we have. It's roughly about 40% for XP and about 80% for Vista. I guess at the end of the day, my answer about the secure privacy, about people who are really, really concerned is you can turn it off. You don't have to send us your error reports. And the great thing is, like, if half the world turned off their error reports, we'd still have enough to find
those
bugs.
You're getting good stuff, though, right? You're getting good things out of it.
Yeah, yeah.
It seems like it's awesome work.
Yeah.
You want to encourage people to use it, I guess.
Well, so I will say this. So I did this initial study. I didn't put it in the paper because I couldn't figure out how to write it in such a way that no one would try to misquote me. Okay? And when we figured out how to do that, we'll publish a paper. I'll promise. Okay? One last.
Vikram Krishnaprasad from Cornell University. So does analyzing all these bugs tell you anything about common errors that programmers make? And can you use that information to check our system to avoid these kind of bug patterns in the first place?
Check for null.
Yeah, as Kirk says, check for null is the most important one. We actually have generated quite a few guidelines that have fit into our internal development process. And we have, I know Vince Orgovan has gone and given talks to people externally about, hey, look, these are the kind of fixes, bugs we see, go fix them. Okay, is that good?